You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Everyone these days could use a little support, and your friends at the ESO Network are no different. With the ESO Network Patreon, the cool thing is when you help support us, it's you who will benefit. With four tiers starting for as little as 25 cents a week, you can listen to some of your favorite network podcasts early, hear exclusive content, maybe get some ESO swag, or even possibly take a shot at the geek seat. All you need to do is sign up at patreon.com/ESO Network.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 258 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Batman 89 number 2, Batman Urban Legends number 7, Superman and the Authority number 3, Justice League Last Ride number 5, The Joker number 7, Titans United number 1, Rorschach number 12, I Am Batman number 1, Justice League number 67, Wonder Woman number 779, Infinite Frontier number 6, Supergirl season 6 episode 11, Mixie in the Middle, Stargirl season 2 episode 6, Summer School chapter 6, Titans season 3 episode 3, Hank and Dove, and Why the Last Man season 1 episode 1, The Day Before. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, Cletus, first up for DC news. A Batgirl series starring Cassandra Cain and Stephanie Brown is launching December 14th. The series will be written by Becky Cloonan and Michael Conrad and drawn by Jorge Corona.
Yeah, I'm not super surprised by this news. I mean, we've seen them, you know, really highlighting the Batgirls as a team, which is kind of cool. And I'm curious to see, you know, the direction that they take this series in. I'm a little surprised it seems to be an ongoing, which is a surprising move, if I'm being honest, because DC traditionally has not been a believer in either of those two as Batgirls long term.
Now, I've been wondering if this is going to be their next versions of Birds of Prey, even though they're calling it Batgirls, because you're going to have the two Batgirls and Oracle working together. So That's what I'm seeing it as, is kind of like a Birds of Prey kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a clear connection there. Yeah, it'll be, like I said, I'm definitely interested to see what they do with the series. And there's definitely a lot to do. I mean, with the, you know, with the new era that we're in with these characters, you've got Barbara that's sort of both Oracle and very rarely, occasionally also Batgirl still. You know, you got Cassie doing her thing as Orphan / Batgirl. And we've got Spoiler / Batgirl also with Stephanie. So, and you've got Stephanie with the recent Tim Drake change going on. It's going to be very, I think there's a lot of interesting things to explore early on in the series, even, you know, before we get into whatever the writers want to actually do with their stuff too.
Agreed. And it'll be interesting what they're actually going to be calling them. Because we can't keep referring to both of them as Batgirl all the time. That'll just get confusing.
I would think they'd want to keep... I mean, Spoiler and Orphan, to me, work. Spoiler especially has been Spoiler for a while. I know the Orphan one would be easy for a lot of people to maybe not know or to have not read, because that era is both relatively new and they didn't use her a ton. But I would just go with those. It just makes more sense to me.
Yeah, me too. All right, up next for DC News, Tom King and artist Greg Smallwood's 12-issue Black Label series, The Human Target, will debut November 2nd. Christopher Chance will have 12 days to solve his own murder.
Very excited. You know I enjoy Tom King, and him writing some version of a murder mystery is pretty exciting.
Yeah, because we got something similar to that with Rorschach. So it'll be interesting to see an actual detective story, so.
Yeah, and I have to say also, I really like what they're doing with King, and they're just kind of handing him miniseries to work on. As I've said a number of times, I feel like that's where he really shines through because he's able to tell a very tight story. So this is phenomenal. To me, that's even if this one doesn't turn out to be his best stuff, this is what I would love for him to continue working at DC, specifically doing these sorts of miniseries, because I think that's just how you get the best stuff from him.
Agreed. All right, next up for DC News. Kami Garcia has two young adult novels being released soon, a new Teen Titans book, and a new take on John Constantine. In Constantine Disordered Illusions, a teenage version of the Hellblazer takes center stage, alongside his punk rock band, Mucous Membrane. The story follows Constantine as he learns about the dark arts while joining the band in the United States. Teen Titans Robin will spotlight both the original Robin, Dick Grayson, as well as the newest boy wonder, Damian Wayne.
It's an interesting pitch. I think that's all about I got to add to that, but yeah, I'm intrigued for sure.
Yeah, so it's good to see that they're still putting books out for young adults that revolve around the superheroes. I mean, a while back, I remember them putting out a Batman one with a young Bruce Wayne, a young We saw a young Diana book and a young Clark book. And I read all those. They were pretty good. So
And I
it's.
think again, you raise a good point, Drew, in that DC is clearly learning where the young adult audience really is at. And it's not in monthly issues. It's just not what they're reading. And whether that's young adult books or putting out, full graphic novels targeted towards young adults. Like I know one of the ones that I think it's a graphic novel, the one with Beast Boy and Raven that was in a bunch of ads for the comics we read this week. That's the sort of thing that they need to keep doing to get that audience. And, it's encouraging to see that DC is clearly finally on top of that.
Yes. All right, up next for DC News, HBO Max Chief Casey Bloys has announced several upcoming DC projects in various stages of development, including Peacemaker, Green Lantern, Justice League Dark, DC Superhero High, two spin-offs of Batman, and a potential series for John Constantine and Madame Xanadu. The streaming service is also working on original DC films, including Batgirl, Black Canary, Blue Beetle, and Static Shock. I think a lot of these we've talked about before, but one of them that was new to me was the DC Superhero High. I don't remember hearing about that one. So that's interesting.
Yeah, and is that supposed to be for HBO Max?
Yes.
Interesting. That's
All the
interesting.
things I just mentioned were all for HBO Max.
That's intriguing because I feel like HBO Max has leaned more, like, fairly heavily into being adult entertainment. Not just with their DC stuff, but I feel like in general, a lot of the big stuff that gets released, for the most part, obviously, Space Jam being an exception to that, has been, older audience targeted stuff. So that's an interesting shift because you can see them trying to maybe expand their audience a little bit with that.
Yeah, well, I know HBO Max has Sesame Street now, because that used to be on PBS, and for some reason, a year or two ago, they moved over to HBO Max, which I thought was weird, but whatever.
Exclusively?
I don't know if they were exclusive. I'm not sure
There's no
about that.
way. There's no way.
I can't say to that. I just know they're on there.
That, yeah, so a lot of those are interesting. I think we mentioned the Supergirl one before. That one I think is one of the ones I'm most interested in of the spin-offs from the movies that they're doing. Just not because I'm the most intrigued in a Supergirl show, but to see how that does, following up an already existing Supergirl TV show. I think it's going to have some interesting obstacles because, I mean, I've not been a particular fan of the show in the last couple of seasons, but, there are a lot of people that really like that portrayal of Supergirl, and it's particularly Melissa's portrayal of Supergirl, I think, is pretty well liked. So that's going to be interesting for that show to see what happens with that one.
Yes, and there's a rumor that Michael Keaton could be part of that project since he's supposed to be a mentor to her in the movie. But nothing's confirmed, so it was just a rumor I heard.
I mean, even if he's in it just a little bit, I think that's definitely something that helps differentiate it and also gives people a reason to put eyeballs on the show. It's gonna be interesting. Like I said, I like how aggressive Warner Brothers is being with their HBO Max programming in terms of including all this superhero stuff. I worry a little bit, Drew, just because they can't hit on all of them, and I'm mostly curious to see what's the one that they slip up on.
Yeah, so fingers crossed they all stay good.
I mean, yeah, but we know at some point that won't.
Yes, I know. All right, and for our last bit of DC news, the CW releases a poster for Legends of Tomorrow Season 7, providing the first look at Matt Ryan's new character on the show, Dr. Gwen Davies. At the end of Season 6, the Legends had only just defeated Bishop when a mysterious second Wave Rider appeared out of nowhere and destroyed the original version, stranding the team in Texas 1925. The poster for Season 7 shows Sarah, Ava, Nate, and the rest of the gang, minus Mick, of course. And they're all decked out in period-appropriate attire. And then, of course, Matt Ryan's character has a beard.
The period piece costumes were interesting to me, Drew, because I mean, obviously the show's always been a time travel show, but I feel like they don't normally highlight one specific time era, and that's interesting to me because that makes me wonder if maybe we're going to be stuck in one time for a bit.
See, that's what I was wondering too, and that's something we haven't done before. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I can't imagine them being stuck there the whole season, but maybe for a few episodes. All right, well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
So, Brittany, Martha, tell me about your podcast.
Oh, no. It's like we're in sync, but also kind of a disaster.
We are always a disaster.
So, our podcast is fun if you want to hear two people talk about and complain about stuff that they love and also hate.
And drink.
And drink.
And the show is Same. Called.
Oh. but first, let's talk nerdy.
And you can find us on the ESO Network.
Ba-ding. See you next Tuesday.
And we're back. But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. For you.
Let's talk Batman 89 number 2. The issue opens up with Batman surrounded by the National Guard. Batman tells them not to shoot and he tosses a flash grenade. As Batman escapes back up the building, the National Guard starts shooting blindly at him. Four occupants of the building were wounded by stray gunfire. Two remain in critical condition, and a fifth victim fell to his death from a fire escape. The mayor has requested an emergency meeting with the governor, as a massive crowd gather outside the city hall to protest. District Attorney Harvey Dent gives a speech where he grew up in Burnside. He states there are two Gothams because he's lived in both. Some guys dressed up in Batman gear come to Burnside to patrol. One of them sees a PlayStation they want to steal. A kid in a hood shows up and beats the crap out of them, and one of the Batmen who showed up late followed him back to the place where he lives. Bruce Wayne buys a giant penny that Batman used for protection last issue for decoration in the Batcave. Bruce meets with Harvey Dent and others because he wants to fund every school-aged child in Burnside to 4 years of Gotham State University trade/technical school for those who prefer it. When Bruce Wayne is leaving Burnside, the Batman have set the garage that Drake lives above on fire. Catwoman shows up and tags them in for Batman. Harvey Dent runs into Drake's apartment above the garage looking for him. The stairs collapse, and Harvey falls to the ground unconscious with the fire burning around him.
Well, the comic definitely seems to make us think that that's going to be, this fire is going to be what causes Two-Face. I'm assuming it will, but part of me also suspects, Drew, that maybe it's a red herring and something else is going to actually cause the Two-Face incident. I don't know. The interaction he had with the cop at the courthouse made me feel like that's not, this fire is not actually going to be the thing that does it.
That's possible. I'm just reading this version of Batman. It's so different from what we have in the other comics that it feels new. You know what I mean?
Yes, for sure.
So I like that. And it's different. Batman having to escape the National Guard, them trying to hunt him down and hurting people. It's just, it feels different. It's a different world for sure.
Yeah, and it's a Batman that's not, you know, the Batman that we have in the comics is like the most seasoned veteran you can imagine, right? Like, he's done everything. And this one isn't at that level yet, right? Like, he makes a mistake in his escape and causes that kid to get shot.
Yeah, and we see his reaction to that by putting a whole bunch of money towards the kids in Burnside. So we're seeing his reaction to his mistake, too. So I'm definitely enjoying this issue.
I agree. Very excited to see, you know, episode 3 brings. Their version of Robin, I get it. I guess they needed to come up with a reason for why. I guess sometimes I wonder, like, do you need to give me a reason why they call somebody Robin, or can we just accept that Batman's sidekick gets called Robin?
Yeah, we don't have to have a reason for it.
You know what I mean? Because it reminds me of The Dark Knight Rises, that final scene where they call Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character. Is like, oh, your real name? Robin? And it was like, come on.
Yes, I agree. So, all right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Batman Urban Legends number 7. The first story we have is Batman Beyond, and it's called Wake, written by Jackson Lansing and Colin Kelly, and illustrated by Sebastian Chin. It's New Year's Eve. Terry finds Bruce bleeding out in the Batcave. Someone's gotten into the cave systems and overloaded Bruce's pacemaker. After investigating, Terry learns that the villain behind this is a computer superintelligence. Terry causes a blackout in Gotham City and blows up the Batcave in Wayne Manor. This is to be continued in Batman Beyond Neo Year number 1, coming in April 2022.
I liked this issue for the most part, Drew. I did feel, I don't know how to describe it exactly. Like, it was moving really quickly at certain points because it was like the AI was talking about what Terry was doing. I found it would like intersperse, you know, the present of the story, and it would keep cutting back to Bruce's speech to Terry as he dies. And I got that that's what they wanted the comic to be kind of like jumping back and forth between the two. But I found it a little distracting at a certain point where Bruce's speech was so long, Drew. Like, the man's bleeding out. He gave a comics long word speech.
Me, I didn't really care for the story that much. I've read other Batman Beyond comics before, and I've been more into the story than I was with this one. It just didn't draw me into the story that much. I really have no interest in checking out the series coming up. And honestly, that's not what your comic is supposed to do.
I think that's fair. And I think the problem with that, Drew, I totally get why you feel that way, because I felt similar again, because it just was bouncing back and forth. I felt like I never had a chance to fully get into the action. Bruce's speech just went on for so long, and it was good. Like, it was well written, don't get me wrong, but, you know, it's not, there's no action going on there. It's just Bruce talking. And then there wasn't a lot of stuff actually happening in the present of the story for large sections of this story. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's easy for the story to kind of lose people.
Our second story, Damian Wayne Batman 666, The Executive Game, written by Tim Seeley and illustrated by Juan Ferreira. A Damian Wayne Batman makes his way into a building and fights against some of his old foes, Phosphorus Rex, the Weasel, Candyman, Jackanapes, Max Roboto, the Flamingo, and Loveless. Damian sold his soul to some demon or something, and he wants to borrow against it. The last scene we see Damian going after a resurrected Joker. And I'm not sure what's really going on because it was weird because if it seemed like Damian wanted to sell his soul to bring the Joker back. I don't know. It was very strange.
I wasn't clear, I guess, Drew, because there was a scene earlier where there was, I don't know if they were Joker goons. I didn't know if it was actually the Joker or just like another Jokerized zombie-ish thing. I you know what I mean? Like the rules of the world were a little confusing to me. It wasn't super clear to me that it was actually the Joker.
That's fair. I mean, I thought this was a confusing story in itself.
I agree with you. And I was confused. I liked a lot of the build up to it, especially like the first part was a little bit confusing. I was like, I don't totally get what's going on here. But then it was, that part was explained pretty well, you know, when he's negotiating with this demon, talking about wanting to borrow against his soul more. And I was like, okay, all of this makes sense. And then it ended like not only abruptly, but I thought really unclearly. Like I didn't get what the ending was. And I was like, I don't understand. The whole buildup is Damian wants to borrow against his soul to keep, I'm assuming, keep fighting the good fight, but then that's not made particularly clear by the end.
Yeah, it's not. That, I don't know. When I read the story, Baguette was telling me we're going to see some sort of miniseries or something coming out of this story. Or at least that's what it felt like to me. And we were just getting a snippet of it.
I thought so too, but then we didn't get anything. It felt like it was just a one shot, and I was like, "Wait a second, this is just a one shot. I need some closure here."
No kidding, and we definitely didn't get that. All right, moving on to our next story about Cassandra Cain, called "Hunter or Hunted," written and illustrated by Guillemine Singelin. Cassandra Cain tries to get a bite to eat when she is surrounded by the magistrate. She's on the run until she comes across Batman. Batman states he needs her help across town. She replies, "You could have called," and Batman replies he was in the neighborhood. I can tell you, one of the things I didn't like about this story was the artwork.
Oh, I actually really liked the artwork. I thought that was the only reason for the story, if I'm being honest. Like, there was just no justification for the existence of this story, Drew. It did literally nothing. Like, there was literally no point to the story. The only thing I enjoyed was like, well, at least it's stylistic. That was the only thing I thought was of any worth regarding the story.
So I can't agree with you on this one. I didn't care for the artwork that much, and like you said, the story didn't really do anything.
I mean, nothing. I mean, there was as close to little plot progression as possible in a story.
Our last story is called "The Batman with No Name," written by Kenny Porter and illustrated by Baldomir Riveras. Pluto, the prison planet in the 853rd century, Batman the Warden and his robot Robin go after some escapees. The Reader, Hollowbody, Cryo, and Hades. And as this Batman goes after the escapees, we see he's able to transform into any iteration of the Batman. Which, I thought the story was okay, but it was kind of cool seeing the different versions of the Batman, I thought.
Yeah, I think you put it well, Drew. I was very, very intrigued by the premise of the story and would be curious to see the character and the world that it's set in, again, with this Pluto prison planet. But the story itself was fine, I guess.
Yeah, and I'm not really sure we're going to get to see this again, but we might. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Superman and the Authority number 3. Superman and the Authority have to rescue June, who was trapped in her own mind. Only by accepting that she and the Enchantress are the same person can escape Dizamore once she's free. Superman takes June Moon back to the Fortress Superman. We get the origin of Light Ray. She's born on Mars during a cosmic storm. She's rocketed to Earth from a parallel world with all the powers of the rainbow. She's a four-time winner of Celebrity Crisis and has 22 million followers on her social media. We learn that Light Ray has depression, and she's sitting in the dark when someone shows up with an Eclipso diamond. June and Apollo team up to go get Light Ray. She's missing. At Fort Superman, Solomon Grundy attacks Superman. Superman learns very quickly that Ultra Humanite is controlling Grundy. Superman uses his supermobile to fight Grundy, but Grundy rips off the top and pulls Superman out. Ultra Humanite plans to put his brain in Superman's body. To be concluded. It's hard to believe we only got one more issue of this miniseries.
He covers a lot of ground. I'm surprised they only went for 4 issues. My guess is, I'm assuming Grant only wanted to write 4 issues because I can't believe that DC would be like, yeah, only give us 4 instead of 6. But, I mean, Drew, I really feel like we could have easily had 6 issues in this thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of disappointed we got that quick origin of Light Ray. I would have liked to see a little more about her character.
My assumption is Grant, we know, is stepping away from DC for a bit, but my assumption is that he's trying to set this team up for somebody else to take over and do something with. Obviously, it remains to be seen if DC actually intends to do that or not, and maybe they do. Maybe they already have something lined up. But my guess is, while I agree I would have liked to have seen more with her, I assume, at least from Grant's perspective, his hope is that somebody else does take that character and do more with her.
Now, I saw something that I didn't read, but I did see something about Superman the Authority being continued somewhere. So I'm sure we'll see something more about that in the coming weeks. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week, Justice League Last Ride number 5. Brainiac has taken over Cyborg Superman's body and is leading the Manhunters in an attack on Apocalypse. Also, a bunch of bounty hunters have shown up. Wonder Woman and John Stewart battle Mongol, and Mongol's not here for Lobo. He is here for the resources, and we see that Wonder Woman sends him hurtling out in space. In the past, Superman blames Batman for Martian Manhunter's death. Batman corrects him by stating that John sacrificed himself to save Earth. And we see that Steppenwolf is killed by an Amazon. On Oa, Darkseid is absorbing the battery from the central battery. We see Hal Jordan lifts it up and slams it down on Darkseid. And we see a massive explosion occurs, destroying Oa.
So one of the interesting reveals that we got in this, Drew, was that Mongol was, we assumed right in the last couple issues that all of these people were coming specifically for Lobo. And as it turns out, that's not really the case. They seem to be sent intentionally for the Justice League. Mongol says that he was there to just scrap stuff. But as the Justice League suspects, he was probably tipped off by somebody that would be a place worth looking for scraps. And then the other big reveal was there's like a room full of Darkseid clones. And so that's interesting. We're starting to get like a little, you know, like a little bit more revealed, a little more depth, a little more interesting than just kind of the Justice League tries to arrest Lobo.
Yes. I have to say, my favorite scene in this issue was the one where Wonder Woman sends Mongo flying out into space. I love that scene. But yeah, very interesting issue. And Excited to see where it goes from here. All right, up next for DC Comics, we have The Joker number 7. Santa Prisca, a woman is talking business about opening up a Bane experience when her phone rings, and it's Oracle, and she's blown Julia Pennyworth's cover. Julia is not happy with the Bat family for what happened to her father, though she does agree to do an investigation for Oracle. Jim Gordon is cleared of the murders at the laboratory that Joker tried to frame him for. Jim also learns that the laboratory is illegally cloning human tissue. He's very curious why the Joker wants cloned human tissue. Chief Detective Isabella Hollows of Interpol, also known as Madam Halloween, wants to team up with Jim. Madam Halloween wants something actionable on the criminal organization called the Network. And then we see that Lady Bane shows up behind Madam Halloween.
Nothing to do with this story, Drew, but I continue to be stunned that this is an ongoing series and that this story is going on as long as it was. There were really just nothing about it had screamed to me that this was going to be a long-term story. You know what I mean? Like, it clearly has gone that way. Don't get me wrong. Like, the plot we see in this one, clearly there's, you know, a lot more going on than we initially saw. But they really just did not see that coming.
I know. I'm curious what numbers this book is getting. Are they selling a lot of issues of it, I'm wondering?
I would imagine they are because it's the Joker. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like the Batman titles. The worst Batman title still sells better than a lot of the other books, you know, despite being the worst Batman title. So I would imagine it's doing pretty well.
Other than that, I mean, the story is okay, but we're starting to get into where it feels like it's being dragged out. You know what I mean?
Well, I think that I'm intrigued by some of the developments that we got in this, Drew, but we also spent, what was it, at least two issues basically telling disconnected mini stories. It's like you said, I feel like it's dragging on because we basically twiddle our thumbs for a few issues before we got back around to the actual story.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. So that could very well feel like why it's being dragged out. And, you know, I don't know if this, I don't think we ever found out if this was an ongoing or a miniseries for sure. I don't think they've ever said, but it'll be interesting to see when we hit issue 12 if there's going to be an issue 13.
Well, I think there was. Didn't we talk? We talked about, because when Tinian leaves, it was some number that was well higher than what we would expect for a mini series.
Oh yeah, that's right. I forgot all about Tinian leaving. You're right. So. Also in this issue, we had the Punchline backup story, of course. Punchline and her gang are searching the prison to try to find Harper. And Harper is in the ductwork and finally finds Kelly Ness. Kelly's afraid Punchline will kill them both. At home, Harper's brother sees a friend's tattoo and thinks it has something to do with the Joker or Punchline. Instead, the tattoo has to do with the Royal Flush Gang. Which we saw that... Didn't we see a... We saw a member of the Royal Flush Gang in prison with Punchline, like at the beginning of the story, if I remember right.
Yes. Yeah. Well, so, that's what she's taken over. That is what the gang running the prison is, the Royal Flush Gang.
Oh, and Punchline has taken him over. Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah.
I guess I forgot.
The Orca, I think that's what, Orca is the ace of this version, essentially.
Okay, gotcha. So, yeah, I'm still not fully invested in that Punchline story.
I'm not either. And honestly, the Bluebird's, I think it's her brother, right? That's dating the Royal Flush member.
Yes.
That part of the story, like, I'll be honest, every part of the story is bothering me, but that's the one that I think is probably frustrating me the most, because he is just, he might be one of the dumbest characters I've ever read. I mean, Drew, I can't even count the number of red, glaring red flags that he's just waltzed right past.
And I don't feel like this story's ever really given me a good explanation why. You know, like, you're part of the Joker? I can't, that's too far, man. I can't do that. No, it's just the Royal Flush Gang. Oh, okay, that's fine. What? Drew, what?
I don't know, dude. Makes sense. I don't even know why. I'm not even sure why he's in the story. I mean, it's like his part of the story is like totally different than what's going on with his sister.
The problem is, Drew, I feel actually extremely confident that he's in the story because he's inevitably either going to get kidnapped or turned, at least temporarily, by the gang against Bluebird, and we're going to end up with the siblings against each other thing. The problem is that was obvious in literally the very first issue of this, and we're how many issues deep into this side story, and where they're still kind of towing around the bush, and I was just like, guys, come on. This is a very obvious direction you're taking the story. Just commit already.
Just like the first part of the story, we got to drag this one out too.
Ugh.
That sums it up. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Titans United number 1. San Francisco, a man is walking down the street talking on a cell phone to his girlfriend. Suddenly he complains about his eyes and shoots lasers out of them. And it reminded me of Cyclops from the X-Men. The Titans show up and try to calm the man down. He turns into a green gorilla as if he was Beast Boy. Beast Boy, as a lion, tries to stop the green gorilla, and the green gorilla zaps Beast Boy with star bolts. Superboy tries to save a man who's about to fall off the edge of a building. Superboy's powers give out, and Red Hood catches Superboy before he hits the ground. Next, the man starts glowing. He knows he's about to explode. Superboy grabs the man and flies him into the sky where he explodes. Superboy falls back to Earth and is injured. After some research, Nightwing discovers the man's real name is Evan Morton. Jason Todd is being an ass in this issue to Connor. Connor decks him. Luckily, Connor's powers were not working again. Hank calls the Titans for help, and he and Dove are battling Kite Man, who now has powers. First thing I want to say about this issue, Cletus, is this felt like, to me, this felt like a comic that was trying to base itself off the Titans TV show.
Oh, absolutely. 100% agree with you, Drew. I thought that was very clear.
Which, I didn't mind that at all. I like this issue. When I started reading it, I saw Red Hood was in it. I was like, what the heck is Red Hood doing in here? He doesn't seem to fit. And I think that his only purpose is to be an antagonist to Superboy. And maybe some other people on the team. And I'm sure you love the fact that Kite Man was in this.
Oh, I loved it, Drew. That was the best part of the comic. Easily the best part of the comic. I was not personally a fan of the scene where Connor punches Jason because I felt like they kind of glazed over it. They were just like, oh, well, thankfully your powers weren't working. It was like, yeah. Thankfully, his powers weren't working because Jason Todd's head would be off of his shoulders right now. What are you talking about? I was like, what? How are we just glazing over this?
Yeah, I know what you mean. And Connor should have known better than to do that.
It's one thing. The thing is, Drew, I feel like they could have phrased it differently and it would have been fine. If Connor had been like, I knew my powers weren't working. And so I, you know, used it as an excuse to let loose. I can accept that. That's a little silly, but I can accept it. But he didn't know. Drew, the story makes it clear that he threw that punch under the impression, obviously not, you know, consciously, but under the impression that his powers were intact. I know it was a minor detail in the story, but I was like, come on now, guys. Like, I know Jason was trying to antagonize him, but come on.
So, I enjoyed this issue, and I'm looking forward to more of them.
I'm intrigued a lot by these people getting the Titans' powers, and obviously it feels reminiscent of like Parasite or Amazo, and I'm curious if it's going to be something similar to that or if we've got something new on our hands.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to find out. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Rorschach number 12. The issue starts off with our detective and Alan trying to convince security to let them bring in a tape recorder. The detective asks for a drink, and the governor Turley mentions that the night boy didn't make it in tonight because of a car accident. The detective, Alan, and Turley all sit down and drink a beer while discussing the case. When the governor is ready to listen to the tape, the detective presses a button on the tape recorder. Then, the detective kills both Turley and Alan. The detective presses play on the tape, and a past speech of Turley's is being played. The detective washes his hands in the bathroom. Next, he puts his overcoat on, which hides all the blood. And then the detective tells the security guard on his way out that Alan and Turley were going over the governor's speech. When the detective picks up his car, the valet mentions something about the dent in the front of the car looks fresh, and the detective states it was a hit and run. The issue ends with the detective going to the movie theater to see Pontius Pilate, War of the West Indies.
I thought this was a phenomenal final issue, Drew. I mean, it gave us the conclusion, what felt like the inevitable conclusion of the story, which was, you know, the detective we had already seen, he had figured out who truly actually was behind all of this, and they're held accountable in the kind of very gruesome fashion that we would expect from Rorschach. Obviously he's not Rorschach, but we still get, again, that somewhere that more clever, you know, criminal mastermind stuff where we see all the steps that he went through to set even that thing up, right? He runs over, was it the driver or the aide or something like that, so that he's not in the room with them. He makes sure that he's got the recording of the speech. So he's got like all of that together. Again, we just get another taste of what they've been doing this whole series. And I was thrilled with this whole series. Has just been phenomenal.
Yeah. And it wrapped it up pretty good. Justice was served, huh?
Exactly. And you get that in Pontius Pilate's speech that he's watching at the end. He talks about that he'll do, you know, whatever it takes to make sure that justice is done. And that's, you know, clearly exactly what the detective took into his own hands to do.
Yep. And the other thing I thought about when I read this issue is, you know, with Turley gone, we know that the Redford's going to stay president even longer in the Watchmen world. So I'm curious if we're going to see anything else from the Watchmen world coming out soon or not, or if we're going to get a break from it for a while.
I don't know. I imagine we will again at some point, Drew, because it sells. I mean, the series did very well, the TV series that is. I don't know how this did as a comic series. I'm sure it did pretty well, and it's designed just by its nature to do even better as a graphic novel. And just in general, Watchmen tends to sell. I know every time they come up with something, there's always a huge backlash of people grumbling that they don't want more Watchmen stuff, which is fair. Honestly, I get it. But people inevitably still tune in. So I would not be shocked if at some point they come back to something with the Watchmen again. I think what they've found right now, Drew, with the post-Watchmen world that they've kind of established, there's something there, because I feel like you're successfully not meddling with what Alan Moore did. I think that was sort of the problem when they did those prequel comics, that you're kind of sticking your fingers in what Alan was trying to do, right? You're kind of retelling and maybe refocusing on the story that he was doing and the characters that he told. But if you just move it like the show and this comic did, you know, a couple decades into the future, you're really kind of able to do whatever you want, right? Because you're not changing anything that happened in his story, and you're just kind of doing, well, what would the world look like if it kept going after the end of Watchmen?
Yeah, that's very true. And I agree with you on that. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. I Am Batman number one. Jason's new Batman suit is ready. The gauntlets have extendable tethered batons, and the cowl faceplate is made with a military-grade biohazard filter. The belt is mostly filled with burner phones. The new suit is low-tech to keep the magistrate from tracking Batman. Jay seems to have no interest in using batarangs or a grappling gun. Apparently, Batman has been gone for 6 years. Jason's plan is to have Batman seen, not as a myth or a legend, in the shadows. He plans to fight the way Tatsu and Vase trained him, up close and man-to-man. Batman tells some kids they have some sick tags referring to their graffiti. Batman tells them to respect other people's property and put them someplace else. Batman stops someone who is joyriding and hurting people. Batman tells him to turn himself in before the folks who are taking video cancel him for real. Batman helps some cops by taking down some radicals, and the cops are appreciative and tell Batman to get out of there before the magistrate show up. Whitaker and his partner respond to a call in Alleytown about a mask. They find a dead mask who looks an awful lot like the villain Anarchy.
This issue was fine, but I personally, Drew, was really confused at the setting of the story appearing to be in the future into a well-established magistrate era. I didn't realize we were there, I guess. I thought we were in the present of what DC's doing.
You weren't the only one confused by the setting. With him saying Batman's been gone for 6 years, it didn't feel right to me.
I will admit I could be wrong, but I swear that that had not been the case. That felt like a line that got added this issue to like change when it was supposed to be taking place. I almost wonder if DC changed their mind on something where they were intending to have the two both be active and then somebody came in and said, no, we're going to have this take place in the future.
Your gut feeling sounds right to me, because I had a feeling, I thought this was supposed to be taking place at the same time. It's hard for me to believe the magistrate's been around that long and the rest of the Bat family hasn't done anything about it. Are they all gone at this point? Are we even going to see them interacting with the next Batman? I don't know.
Yeah. I wonder again if that's why we got a issue zero. I almost feel like issue zero was meant to be issue one, and then there was a change. And so they were like, well, this is still the ideal introduction to the character, so let's put that out. But then we need to rewrite what we're doing, and that's why we have issue one now. Obviously, I have no idea, Drew, but I feel right. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, and I think you might be right, because it did feel odd that this was suddenly 6 years later. And we've had no Batman in Gotham. So I'm very curious how this is going to tie into what's presently going on in the Batman. Is the story in the regular series going to lead into this one? Is it going to be something totally different? I'm just curious, because this, it could end up being its own thing, not tied to what's currently going on. Very curious to see how it's going to play out.
I feel like that's why it got moved to the future, Drew. I think they got cold feet, and the safer thing is to set it into the future, because then it's not tied to anything. And they can, I mean, in some ways it's good for the author because he has the freedom to tell the story the way hopefully he wants to. But in other ways, it is very much a cowardly move from DC, because I think they want to have their cake and eat it too.
Which is probably what's going to happen. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Justice League number 67. Leonardo Lane, also known as the Damon Rose, was attacked by a Deathstroke wannabe. Lois asked him if he was distracting the Justice League while someone attacked it. Superman, the Justice League, and the United Order are all battling Sinmar, who seems to be getting stronger with each attack. Batman uses the Phantom Zone projector to send Sinmar Utopica to the Phantom Zone. As the leader of the United Order, Hawkslayer demands that Superman turns over the Phantom Zone projector, but Superman refuses. And at the end of the issue, Leonardo gets attacked by a large group of Deathstrokes.
Drew, I was very, very frustrated that a significant portion of this issue was dedicated to establishing this team of the United Planets that I don't think anybody other than Bendis himself is going to use. I mean, we got the full classic Bendis text introductions to each of these guys, and I was like, are you planning on using them a lot? Are they going to pop up more than one time ever?
This is the Justice League title, not the United Order title.
Exactly. Well, yes, that exactly. And on top of that, he's really the only one doing a whole lot with the United Planet. So it's not like they're likely to pop up in another book other than one that he's writing. And so it just to me personally, Drew, it felt very self-indulgent.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with you on that because I didn't really care for this issue that much. I don't really want to see Superman at odds with the United Order, honestly.
The other reason I did not like this issue, Drew, was because the resolution of just using the Phantom Zone projector was so easy and so obvious. And I know that Bendis tried to make a point that Superman really, really did not want to use the Phantom Zone projector. But, I mean, my dude waited until the Hall of Justice was completely dismantled and he was about to start murdering people left and right. And then was like, I still don't know we should use this, guys. I was like, come on, dude. Come on.
I know. It felt very weird. Superman's used that thing before with no problem.
And they made it so easy. The conflict was over instantly over when they used it. And I know that's the point of the Phantom Zone projector, but it was like, you can't have a multi-issue fight like that and that anticlimactically. I mean, that was just absurd. It felt honestly like what it was, that he didn't actually care that much about the conflict and he really just wanted to remind you that he had created this villain. And hey, wouldn't it be cool if we maybe did some more with this cool villain that I made? And then let me introduce this other team just to, again, show off, I guess, that I can make new characters and look at my comic genius in these brilliant characters that I've created that are literally just Hawkman with a different name and Starfire with a different name.
All right, let's go to the backup story in this. Justice League Dark. Old Atlan Templus Atlantis. Merlin and John Constantine are inside. Outside, Justice League Dark are getting ready to defend as Merlin's army of dead Atlantean soldiers attack. Aquaman summons an army of sharks. Zatanna makes her way into the old Atlan Templus and casts a spell. Crackle DNA burn. To be continued. I was disappointed that we didn't get much in this story except for setup, because it went by very quickly.
Yeah, it's frustrating, Drew, because the lead story has, I think, every single issue clearly been the inferior story to the backup. And it's just, again, if this was the only way to get Justice League Dark, fine. But God, it is so clearly the better comic, and it's so frustrating that it gets a third of the space.
Agreed. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week. Wonder Woman number 779. Dead Man is dead in Diana's arms, killed by the future Janice with the God Killer. Janice raises the weapon to strike at Diana, but she blocks it with her bracelet. Janice raises the weapon for a second blow when she's stopped by Siegfried. Wonder Woman uses the lasso she got from Asgard, and she's able to bring Dead Man back with it. The strings of fate show up and are about to snip future Janice from existence when Diana asks them for mercy and a chance for redemption for Janice. Diana takes the needle that Odin gave Siggy back in Elf Fame, and Diana uses it to sew past and future Janice back together. Diana refuses an offer to join the gods of Olympus, and Diana also refuses an offer to return to Asgard. Instead, Diana takes the God Killer and uses it to make a portal for herself. And then next issue, we're supposed to get Diana's return.
And that's issue 800, right?
No, that's issue 780.
I remembered the 9, and I remember thinking, well, they timed that very well.
I'm sure Wonder Woman number 800, when we get to it, it's going to be a big issue. Because right. They always like to make big issues out of the big numbers like that. But we got almost 20 issues to go.
This was pretty good. I liked how they tied back a lot of, you know, the whole journey. Again, it helps make it feel like this entire run post death metal has served a purpose, right? Like, it's not just been the Asgard story was great, but it would be easy to just kind of leave it at that. And then, obviously, Siggy was relevant throughout, you know, the whole story, but a lot of stuff, the rope comes back, Odin's needle comes back so that they can tie Janice together again. Like, all of it, again, just the full beginning to end arc of the story was just so well done. I'm really hopeful to see what the next arc is going to look like, and I hope they can match the quality of this one, because this was just very well done.
I hope so, too. And I hope they keep bringing in things that have to do with the Pantheon, too, like we've seen here in the afterlife. So, we'll see.
The other thing I wanted to mention was this was yet again, we're getting a ton of this. I wonder, Drew, if Snyder really kind of opened the floodgates with his commentary in both Justice League and Death Metal. But this was, and this has been clear for a few issues now, how obvious of a commentary this was on the idea of comic continuity, and, you know, the metaphor being that you can't only just be beholden to the past of comics and just preserve, you know, everything as it has been, but at the same time, you can't purely look into the future, New 52, and ignore everything that has happened before that. It's interesting. This is a very interesting era of superhero comics, Drew, and I don't think it's going to last that long because there's really only so much to say, but just we're getting so many different people's takes essentially on, like, DC Comics, basically, and the like philosophy that goes behind running that company. It's very interesting seeing how many different, you know, writers are kind of chipping in with their superhero metaphors.
Yeah, it's really interesting. All right, we also had the Young Diana backup story wrap up this issue also. We had the Colosseum of Themyscira. Diana is excited that Cleo is going to be competing with elite Amazon warriors. Queen Hippolyta gives a speech about sharing woes and pride, and the queen puts the spear in a place of honor. Diana joins her mother to watch the competition and learns that she can compete.
This one was much, much more of an epilogue than the lead story. Felt like we got the essentially true conclusion last issue, and this was sort of just like the, you know what I mean, like the closing few minutes of the movie. That's what this felt like. It was good. It was certainly nice, but it really was, you know, just kind of an epilogue to what we had gotten.
Definitely. All right, well, let's move on to our last title for this week. Infinite Frontier number 6. Darkseid gives a big speech how he's going to control the whole multiverse. Obsidian tries to free Roy from Darkseid's control. President Superman goes to save Flash when he's stopped by Machine Head. Next, Machine Head attacks Thomas Wayne, and Machine Head tells Thomas after he's through killing him, he'll destroy Earth Zero. President Superman recovers and takes out Machine Head. Next, President Superman goes to rescue Barry. Barry shatters through some sort of force field and disappears. Darkseid states that everyone is doomed. The Black Ring has gone quiet, the Flash is gone, the crack is lost. The Omniverse has been taken from Darkseid, and Darkseid blames Psycho Pirate, but Psycho Pirate disappears, stating he's needed in another event. Darkseid zaps Machine Head with his Omega Eyes. Darkseid states this battle is over, and he zaps everyone with his Omega Beams, returning them home. Earth Zero, a few days later, Agent Chase and Roy Harper drink a multiverse beer together. Agent Chase is now in charge of the DEO, and Roy Harper is going to go look for his daughter. The JSA has returned to Earth Zero and check in with the Totality. There were no changes to the space-time balance, but Earth Omega is hidden. We see Bones is back with Checkmate. On Earth Omega, Darkseid talks to Extract and tells her that he let the heroes live because all the heroes of the multiverse will play a role in the upcoming wars, just as Darkseid's family will. Then we see frames of Trigon, the Upside Down Man, Eclipso, Necron, and the Great Darkness. In the epilogue, the Flash stops running. He finds himself in the Multiverse 2, where he runs into Pariah. Pariah touches Barry, and he disappears from existence and reappears in Earth Flash 1, where he's having dinner with his Flash family and what looks like to be the Silver Age. Now, these stories are supposed to be continued in Justice League Incarnate number 1, which is supposed to be out in November, and also sometime in 2022.
A lot of this kind of frustrated me, Drew, because it ultimately not a lot happened of consequence in this story. I mean, the only real casualty, so to speak, was Machine Head, who, I mean, what? Okay. You know what I mean? Like, there are things that happen, like Roy Harper is fully alive again. Okay. Apart from, I mean, and then Darkseid, we already knew was alive, but apparently it's a singular Darkseid. But that's also not different. That's been an idea that's been around before. And I'm honestly, Drew, I'm a little bit surprised, I guess, that Williamson has missed that idea. That was sort of the whole point in Final Crisis. And then also following that in Multiversity with Grant Morrison, his idea of Darkseid essentially in his mind as the devil of the DC universe was that there was one Darkseid. There was one Apocalypse. That, you know what I mean? Like, there was a multiverse, but there was a singular Apocalypse, and there was the singular world for the New Gods. So there weren't multiple Orions. There was like a Orion also.
Right, and that's how I understood the multiverse, that the gods were outside of the multiverse. There wasn't multiple versions of them.
And so again, so that was that didn't necessarily bother me, but I was surprised when Williamson wrote that like all the different versions of Darkseid coalesced into one. I was like, but there's only ever been one Darkseid. That's always sort of been the point of that character. And I get a writer not necessarily, you know, being on top of that, but I was surprised that the editorial team and Jim Lee and everybody else, nobody caught that. I thought that was odd. Obviously, they're setting up, you know, what is going to ultimately be a conflict of Darkseid versus the DC heroes. Great. I have no problem with that. The thing that was most intriguing to me was what Pariah did, and he sort of almost seemed to be trying to bottle up the world into a happier era. And again, this was yet another sort of metafictional take on what we're seeing here, where we see Pariah trying to do what some fans do and try and just cling to the Silver Age or whatever age that they like, right? And those are the only good comics, and let's just stay in that era. That was really intriguing to me.
Yeah, that was interesting, to say the least. So, obviously, we're getting some big event coming in 2022. And I'm sure Williamson's going to be the one driving it.
Oh, I would be stunned if he wasn't. Unfortunately.
All right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk our DC television shows.
Welcome to Dr. Geek's Laboratory.
Dr. Geek here with another reminder that the ESO Network is pro-science and pro-vaccine. We urge you to be a superhero and protect yourself, your family, and your fellow geeks around the world. Don't be fooled by the forces of evil and their anti-science misinformation campaign. Consult the latest CDC guidelines, your doctor, and get the COVID vaccine today.
And we're back. Let's talk Supergirl, Season 6, Episode 11, Mixie in the Middle. At the end of the last episode, Supergirl is trapped in ice by Nixley and is forced to watch the building she saved last episode destroyed. Supergirl calls on Mr. Mixypillilick for help, but apparently so did Nixley. Nixley is not happy with Mixie because 300 years ago he stood in front of a judge and called Nixley crazy. Mixie states, that's because you tried to destroy most of the fifth dimension. Mixie frees Supergirl from the ice and Supergirl flies Mixie to safety. Mixie gives us Nixley's origin to the tune of I Will Survive. And we learn that 1,000 years ago there was an evil imp named Jared who created an all-powerful All-Stone to give him mastery over everything. The other imps found out about it and banished Jared and blew up the All-Stone, scattering the pieces across the known universe, where they become totems of truth, destiny, love, dreams, hope, humanity, and courage. Nixley needs totems to create a new All-Stone. Nixley needs the orb to find the totems. To give the power to the crystal, the orb needs the blood of Jared inside it, which Mixie has. Lena returns to her hometown where her mother grew up in Newfoundland. She gets a warm welcome until she states her mother's name, Elizabeth Walsh. Then she is suddenly turned away from the hotel. When she goes to the bar, she learns that her mother killed the bar owner's mother. A giant cat is attacking National City, and the super friends show up to stop it. Lena learns the truth about her mother, that she was a witch. When her friend Margaret started showing up with bruises on her face, the women knew her husband Tommy was abusing her. The women took matters into their own hands, and they only meant to scare Tommy, but the magic got away from them, and he was burned alive. Lena's mother escaped to the States and took up with Lionel Luther. She was living under his control because she no longer trusted herself. Dreamer disguises herself as Mixie, but the magic of the gem disrupts her disguise. Nixley captures the Super Friends and uses them as bait to draw out Mixie. When Nixley calls on a dragon to kill the Super Friends, Mixie comes to the rescue. Supergirl gives a speech about working together, but Nixley doesn't want to hear it and instead traps Mixie inside the gem. Nixley teams up with Mitch in search of the first totem, the Totem of Courage. When you control courage, you also control fear. Supergirl wants to find the totems before Nixley. Man, that was tiresome just reading it.
You're more dedicated to that recap than I would have been, Drew. I tell you what. I know that this show has an audience, but if there is a wrong way to watch this show, it is to watch it and then watch the other shows that we're going to talk about on this podcast, because woof, it does not stack up well.
My whole point of putting it first is to get it out of the way.
Oh, I agree. But man, Drew, it's just one of those things. Like, I was not enjoying it even when it was just being compared to its fellow Arrowverse peers. But whoa, once you take it out of that and put it side by side with, you know, Why the Last Man and Titans and Stargirl, whoa, boy. Not good.
And clearly, Nixley is going to be the villain in the second half of this season that they're going to be going up against. And it looks like it's going to be a race to find these totems.
Which, the whole All-Stone thing is just so... I don't know if that's... I would assume that might have been like some Silver Age story at some point, or they're making it up, but... It's one of those silly MacGuffins where it feels a little bit, Drew, like they're chasing after the Infinity Gauntlet. And I just don't know that I need Supergirl to do that, if I'm being honest.
I'm not going to disagree with you.
The other thing that I... The other quick takeaway I wanted to mention
from this episode is the Lena Luthor thing feels just absolutely way, way too late into the game for us to be doing this right now. Like, we are learning new, like, we're getting like a whole new version of this character, essentially crossing over into magic, which is fine, except there's like, what, two episodes, three episodes left at most?
No, we got, we're only on episode 11. We got quite a ways to go.
Oh, that's terrible.
I hate to disappoint you, but
but still, my point still stands. The show is ending, and we are establishing completely new stuff for the character, in my opinion, way, way too late. It would have been, for example, obviously, there was us included. We were hopeful at some point Diggle might become Green Lantern. On the other hand, I would have not been particularly happy, Drew, if they had introduced that like halfway through the final season. You know what I mean? Because it had been a little too late. It had been like, wait, what are we doing? Right? And they slowly build up on that. And they're like, well, you couldn't have done this at the beginning of the season. You couldn't have done this last season, so we could actually spend some time actually doing something with this. You know, obviously they didn't do that. And I think ultimately the decision they made was right, which was put it at the end, because then you explore it somewhere else. This, to me, frustrates me because, I mean, honestly, it feels like the only reason they're doing this, Drew, is because that she's going to be the magic thing that beats Nixley at
exactly.
the end of the season.
That's exactly why they're doing it. That I saw that when I was watching this episode. I'm like, oh, so Lena's going to take care of Nixley at the end of this season.
And that's frustrating, right? Like, that, like, not that Lena can be the one that takes her out. That's fine. I don't care. It's the fact that it's obvious why they're doing that plot line, and that's really the only reason they're doing that plot line, is they're basically just building in a, this is how the villain's going to lose. Really precise storytelling. Well done, guys. Well done.
And with that, I think it's time to move on to our next episode. Stargirl Season 2, Episode 6, Summer School, Chapter 6. The issue starts off with Yolanda working at the diner. First, a customer is upset with their steak being well done instead of medium. Then Yolanda has an encounter with Isaac, who states he saw the pictures of Yolanda took of herself. Second, he states he knows what Yolanda and her friends did to his parents. Artemis Croc throws a baseball, knocking Beth's phone out of her hand and breaking the screen. Artemis tells Beth it's going to be nerd versus jock. Cameron comes by the art room and finds Pat and Courtney cleaning up. The art teacher went to a mental hospital, so Courtney and Pat volunteer to clean up. They find a painting of Cindy Berman holding the Eclipso diamond. Zeke talks Mike into building something for Stripesy. Mike picks out a giant drill bit when he's confronted by Cindy Berman. She doesn't want Mike for the team, she wants him as bait. When Pat goes to get Stripesy, he's attacked by Isaac, the new fiddler, and Artemis Croc, the sportsmaster too. They're not here to kill Pat, they are after the robot. Pat's in the hospital with a bad concussion. Mike is missing, and the other JSA members discover that Stripesy has been destroyed. Cindy calls Courtney on Mike's phone. Courtney is supposed to meet Cindy in the cafeteria in 1 hour, or Mike dies. Barbara calls Shade and lets him know that Cindy Berman has the black diamond. The JSA and the ISA have a big epic battle in the cafeteria. Beth is able to locate Mike and free him. Working together, the JSA defeat the ISA, and Cindy gets out the Eclipso diamond and the Shade shows up. Eclipso takes over Cindy's body and attacks the Shade. Stargirl attacks the diamond with her staff. The diamond shatters and Eclipso is free. Eclipso feeds on Isaac. Then Eclipso flicks a piece of the black diamond at Cindy. It turns into a black puddle on the floor and sucks Cindy inside of it, and then she disappears. The Shade attacks Eclipso, and Eclipso states that the Shade's powers come from his home. Then Eclipso attacks the Shade. The Shade disappears into a cloud of black smoke. Stargirl tries to attack Eclipso with her staff. Eclipso grabs the staff and is able to depower it, and Eclipso runs off into the night. Eclipso becomes the little boy we see from episode 1, walking down the street and laughing at his newfound freedom. Man, this was a great episode.
Phenomenal episode. And again, it's surprising how well this show is doing the dark and, you know, horrifying, considering we talked about how bright and bubbly the show normally is. The way it's handling just being the complete opposite of that is impressive. This was good. This was a great conflict between the two teen teams that we had seen building up for a couple seasons. And then the reveal of Eclipso, like the true Eclipso. Phenomenal costume design, not surprising. This show's been pretty good about that. It's good stuff. My only little nitpick, Drew, was Artemis. It might be the strongest human being alive. Because she was going toe-to-toe with Our Man, and she's just a person.
That's true. But one thing I gotta say, the fight scene in this, it was well choreographed, and it was pretty long. I was surprised how much money they probably put in special effects for this episode, and how long the fight scene was. Of all the CW shows, I don't remember fight scenes being this long.
I would say Arrow had some pretty long and very well choreographed fight scenes, but certainly not with the same budget as this.
No, this is obviously given a better budget, and I'm happy about that, because we can see a better quality in this show.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think it's, and again, reaching the point of how much attention to detail they gave to the fight scene, that's good, right? Because it's sort of the climax of the first half of the show. You know, we've gotten this build up. We've seen these teen villains kind of slowly building up in the background. This is, again, one of the few times we've seen the team as a whole come together and fight. Like, we've seen some, obviously the conclusion of last season, we got a true fight scene. We got some, like, a little bit of conflict against the paint monster, but it was really just them all kind of standing and screaming. So, yeah, when you finally, you know, kind of crack your knuckles and go down to a true fight between all of these characters, they did an excellent job.
So, yeah.
And the other thing I wanted to mention, I thought that they were going to kill Shade, and I was preemptively frustrated by that. Because I was like, they're doing him so well, and they've not done enough with that character yet. So I was glad to see that he survived.
Yeah, they're not done with him yet. So, looking forward to the back half of this season for sure. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Titans, Season 3, Episode 3, Hank and Dev. Dick digs up Jason Todd's casket and finds it empty. The Titans want to find Jason and help him. Hank is ready to kill Jason if he needs to. Hank gets a call from Jason asking for help, and Jason tells Hank he knows he screwed up. Jason tells Hank that all the stuff happening to him is not his fault. Something is wrong with him. Garth sends a message to Bruce Wayne telling him that Jason is still alive. Jason is really paranoid about Dick. Jason has Hank go to the Gotham Observatory and destroys his phone. Jason has a new phone for Hank. When Hank gets to the Gotham gym, Jason has him stripped down naked to prove that he's not wired. Hank swims across the pool, and when Hank gets to the other side, Red Hood attacks and knocks Hank unconscious. Hank returns to the Batcave with a bomb attached to his heart. Connor uses his X-ray vision and discovers the bomb is monitoring his heartbeats and is counting down by heartbeat. Jason calls Dick and tells him he'll deactivate Hank's bomb if Dick steals $50 million in gold bars. Corey goes to Gotham PD and has Barbara bring up the morgue security cameras. One of Jason's henchmen take his body from the morgue. Dawn decides she is going to steal the gold bars by herself to save Hank. When Dick follows his lead on Jason, we see that Cyrus Beak's body is dropped on Dick's windshield. That was the henchman, I believe, from the morgue. Dawn brings Jason the gold. She wants the deactivator, and Jason wants her to shoot him. Nightwing shows up and tries to stop Dawn. With seconds left, Dawn shoots. Jason tells her, "Oops, I guess I gave you the detonator." And we see that Superboy is too late to save Hank.
What a good episode, Drew. Oh my gosh.
I know. And I have to tell you, I saw this episode before we recorded last week. You know how hard it was to keep my mouth shut? Because this was such a phenomenal episode. I was so excited to talk about this. I was been waiting for us to get here to talk about it. Man, what an episode. And I don't think we're getting Hank back. I think he's off the show.
He seems pretty dead to me.
I could be wrong, but yeah, I think you're onto something there, Drew.
Well, we basically had a lot of the episodes spent time with Dawn and Hank saying goodbye, so
yeah. So the thing that I was interested throughout this episode, I'm not surprised that someone died at the end of this episode, but I was unsure whether they were really going to follow through on Hank, or I was wondering if they were going to pull the rug out from under us and Jason was going to kill Dawn right at the end. You know what I mean? And so the show had me on the edge, obviously seeing what the conclusion of the bomb was going to be, but I was very sure one of the two was going to die. And I wasn't sure if it was the character the show was telling me it was going to be, or whether they were going to try and like pull a quick one and have it be Dawn. So that was, and then obviously when they bring it, you know, they bring her in isolated, it was like, oh, it could really go either way right now. Very well done. The thing that interests me, Drew, going forward with this show, multiple times, not just Dick, but Starfire as well, both mention that Jason couldn't be doing this on his own. I think the implication partly is that he's not smart enough to do it on his own. And I'm curious if, for example, is Scarecrow helping Jason? And he's kind of playing both sides. That would be a very Hannibal Lecter thing to do, which is how they seem to be playing him. Or are they going to have to come to terms with the fact that it really is just Jason and he really is in control of what he's doing and he's just decided to be a villain, and them trying to struggle with coming to terms with that?
Okay.
It's going to be very interesting.
Yeah, you brought up some good points that I was going to bring up, because I was wondering the same thing. Is Scarecrow behind this? Because I got the feeling that Scarecrow was behind this. But it could also just be Jason, and the show wants us to think that Scarecrow is behind us.
Yeah, that's the thing. I don't know, Drew. I don't know what the right answer is. Obviously, we'll find out from the show. But I think that's a good thing. I'm kind of questioning, and I think it would work either way, because I do think the show is kind of laying the groundwork where they're trying to, and the characters are trying to convince themselves that Jason wouldn't really do this, right? Like there is some level of reluctance from some of the characters, not all of them, to fully accept what's going on during the episode, because they can't accept that Jason would do this. Now, obviously, he has raised the stakes significantly, and that part's not going to be an issue anymore. I think he's going to be they're going to have very little problem with retribution at this point. But I think they're still going to need to come to terms with whether the fact that he really just break bad and he really is this smart and he really is just, you know, playing them as well as he is, or is there somebody else helping him? I think that could be interesting. And honestly, if I'm being honest, I think it might be more interesting if he is actually working on his own. And them kind of trying to come to terms with the fact that, you know, maybe somebody just did go bad. And what do you do with that? And how do you address that? And how we've underestimated this guy at every turn because we didn't believe that he could do this.
Yeah, very interesting. One of the things I wanted to point out was the fact that we had Garth send a message to Bruce Wayne telling that Jason's alive. I think it was strange that Garth would contact him, but I think we needed to have a reason for Bruce to come back, because we knew he was going to come back at some point, and this is the reason here. You know, if Bruce finds out Jason's still alive, that's something that would definitely draw him back to Gotham. And I don't think we'll see Bruce till later in the season, but yeah, it's going to be interesting. All right, well, let's move on to our last episode for this week. Why the Last Man, Season 1, Episode 1, The Day Before. The episode opens up 3 weeks after all the males die. York spray paints a message that says, "Beth, I'm alive. Come home." And we see that on the side of a building. Next, York saves his monkey, Ampersand, from a falling helicopter. Now, I noticed they didn't say the monkey's name in this. I just happened to know it from reading the series. The day before all the males die, we learn that York Brown is a struggling escape artist, and he's giving private lessons for extra money, and he's also having issues paying rent. In Washington, D.C., York's mother is a congressman, Jennifer Brown. She called the president a misogynist on national television. We also learned that Jennifer and her husband are separated and talking divorce. In Brooklyn, Hero Brown, York's sister, is in rehab for a DUI. York meets up with his sister to ask her for money. He needs to buy cheese, crackers, and wine because he wants to ask Beth to marry him. Later on in the episode, we learn that Hero is an EMT in New York. She's having an affair with her married partner. And when Hero learns that her partner lied about telling his wife about their affair, they get into a physical altercation where Hero ends up accidentally killing him. In Oklahoma, Jade is building a bomb for her boyfriend, who's meeting with some radicals. Jade leaves out the bedroom window and jogs away. She blows up the house along with domestic terrorists. As Jade is jogging, she comes across a dead male deer before she is picked up by another agent. And yes, this is Agent 355. And I know they didn't say that in the episode, but that's who she is. And I'm guessing Jade was just an undercover name that she used. Nora Brady works for President Ted Campbell. Kimberly Campbell Cunningham has written a book called Boy Mom and is promoting it. We learn that Beth, York's girlfriend, is going to Australia. York wants to go with her, and we see that York asked her to marry him, so she tells him no. She wants to meet other people, and they get into a big argument. Beth leaves to go grade papers and states she'll be back in a few hours. The next morning, when it is all happening, we see that all the males start dying at once, all except York and his monkey, Ampersand. Very curious what you thought of this first episode, Cletus, especially since this is your first introduction into the storyline.
This was really good. I was very intrigued and very excited to see where the various characters that they introduce go and what the world that is going to develop from this, what that's going to look like. I think the storyline that intrigues me the most from this first episode, Drew, the amazing coincidence, and I don't mean this sarcastically, but the sister, the EMT sister, accidentally kills her boyfriend, right? But then is unbelievably bailed out by every male dying shortly after that happens. And so no one will ever know, theoretically. And so that's going to be, to me, that is so interesting to what I imagine is going to be a part of her character is trying to deal with the fact that essentially she's going to get away with murder for at least, I would imagine, legally. That's not going to become an issue. But how does she deal with that on her conscience that like she can essentially lie and say he died just like every other guy died, right? But that's not really what happened. And seeing that character wrestle with that, I think could be potentially pretty interesting.
Yeah. They introduced a lot of characters we're going to see along the series. And I tried to make sure when I did my recap, I named names and stuff so you and our listeners are kind of get familiar with them. So... I really enjoyed this episode. I ended up watching it twice. Once I watched with no intentions of doing notes, and the second time I watched it was to do notes, because I just wanted to watch it and enjoy it before I dealt with taking notes. And a lot of the characters I remembered some of the characters, and some of them I'd forgotten about. I had to be reintroduced to them myself. So I thought it was a great season opener, and I'm very excited about watching the next episode.
So, Drew, now I'm curious, how does this compare opening-wise to the opening of the comic?
It's been a while since I read it, and I was very... I got to tell you, I almost went and read the first episode or issue just to see how much of it was the same. But of a lot of it, I kind of remember stuff. I can't, because it's been a while since I've read it, I can't say that everything's exactly the same without rereading it. But a lot of stuff did feel the same. So a lot of the characters were the characters out of the comics.
Gotcha. I was going to say, portrayal-wise, how did they do?
Yeah, they did very well. I remembered, of course, Agent 355. I remembered York's mother being a congresswoman. I remember York's sister, Hero, but I couldn't remember if she was recovering from... She probably was. I think she had some issues. I can't remember if she had accidentally killed her partner. So there was stuff I did remember and stuff I didn't remember. So
one thing that I don't think was the fault of the show, but I watched this on Hulu, and I'm under the impression that this show did not have commercial breaks when it aired, because the commercial breaks that I got from Hulu felt like it was just randomly cutting into a scene. And one of the scenes that happened in was when the agent obviously sets up the bomb, right, and then goes into the other room and ultimately leaves out the window before the bomb goes off. She puts on her shoes and goes out the window, and then it cut to commercial, which not terrible commercial placement. And then it came back, and she was leaving the yard and jogged away. And it wasn't clear to me in that moment that we were in the same setting, because everything up to that point we had seen, we were in a city. We were like in an urban setting, right? And then obviously she's just in, what is it, Oklahoma, I believe.
Yes.
And so, again, I don't blame the show. I don't think it's the show's fault. I think if you see all of that together, it's obvious that she gets out of the window and she's just in the yard. But because of where the commercial break happened, and I had a minute and a half to kind of forget exactly how the scene ended, it was a little unclear. I was like, wait, did she build a second bomb? I understood. Like, I was able to piece it together. I was like, oh, I understand what happened. But initially, I was a little bit confused.
Understandable. It seems like the series is going to be doing what the comic did, which is York looking for his girl. He goes in search of his girlfriend, if I remember right. To me, that seems what he's going to be doing in the show, too. I guess it'll be interesting to see how much the show follows the comics. Of course, I've forgotten a lot of it. I'm very intrigued to see how much the show follows the comics.
I'm going to be excited to... I'm definitely, at a certain point, I'm going to want to go and read... I've wanted to read the comic before. But I'm enjoying not knowing what's going to happen. But I am excited to, once this, the show is done or the show gets far enough ahead, to read the comic as well and kind of compare and see what they're doing with each other in comparison.
Yeah, I've been, now that I'm watching the show, I kind of want to go back and read it myself.
Yeah, and it matters less for you too, right? Because you know what's going to happen, so.
Yes. But I've forgotten details, so. All right, well, that wraps up our show for this week. Do you have a shout-out, Cletus?
Yeah, so I'm going to skip what I think is going to be your shout-out and give instead a similar recommendation. There's a graphic novel that came out back in 2015 called Mimetic. That's by Tinian, who's doing the Batman books right now. It's an independent, creator-owned thing. But the basic premise of the story is there's this meme of a sloth giving a thumbs up, and it's literally the cover of the comic. And the meme essentially causes the
slow downfall of civilization, because about, you know, 2 hours after you look at the meme, you die. It's fascinating. And I found it, it's very obviously Why the Last Man's going to go in a different direction somewhat, but I found it interesting in that, like, one day everything's functioning normally, and then very quickly, all of a sudden, society just completely falls apart and nobody knows what's happening. It's very good. Why the Last Man is obviously a big series. This is just a single graphic novel, but is very good, and I highly recommend you check it out. That is Mimetic by Tinian, and then drawn by Eric Donovan.
All right, and for my shout out, I had a shout out planned, but I'm changing it. So I'm actually going to save it for another week. The shout out I'm going to do for this week, my wife's birthday was yesterday. So I'm going to shout out happy birthday to her. But I got her this Wonder Woman 84 card game for her birthday. And we played it last night and we played it earlier today. And it's kind of fun. It's not too complicated. It's simple. Wonder Woman battles against some enemies and you win tokens and stuff. It's kind of fun. So I wanted to shout out about that. Wonder Woman 84, the card game.
Interesting.
All right. Well, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about tonight, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-564-9133. Leave us a message, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got Batman, The Adventures Continue, Season 2, Batman the Detective, Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow, Aquaman the Becoming, Batman, Secret Files, Miracle Molly, Batman, Catwoman, Nightwing, Shazam, Superman, Son of Kal-El, The Flash, and of course our DC television shows, Supergirl, Stargirl, Titans, and Why the Last Man. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
In brightest day,
in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight. Let those who worship evil's might beware my power, Green Lantern's light.
I'm off.
Where are you going?
I've got to go punch a clock with my other boss.
I can see where this is going to be a long commute.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.